From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how medicine was practiced during the Civil War and how medical institutions changed as a result of the war. We'll talk with surgeon and medical historian Ira Rutko about his new book, Bleeding Blue and Gray. Scientists didn't yet know about microorganisms and their connection to disease and infection. Civil War doctors performed surgery in blood and pus-stained coats using dirty instruments. Also, the new movie, Mysterious Skin. Greg Araki's film is adapted from Scott Heim's novel about two boys who are sexually molested and affected in completely different ways. We'll talk with Araki and Heim. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews 33 Swoons by Martha Cooley. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The carnage of the Civil War was an enormous emotional and physical burden for the poorly educated, inadequately trained, and ineffectually organized physicians of the era, writes my guest Ira Rutko. The doctors of that time knew nothing about microorganisms and how they spread disease. Antibiotics were not yet invented, hospitals were unsanitary, and doctors often did as much to spread disease and infection as to stop them. Rutko's new book, Bleeding Blue and Gray, is about how medicine was practiced during the Civil War and how medical institutions changed as a result of the war. Ira Rutko is a clinical professor of surgery at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey and is general editor of an 11-volume series on Civil War medicine. In his new book, Bleeding Blue and Gray, Rutko writes about the Battle of Bull Run, known in the South as Manassas, which killed 750 people and wounded 2,494, with more than 1,500 missing. What were some of the ways that doctors were unprepared to deal with this kind of massive number of people killed and wounded?
Well, you use the most important word that really sort of is the theme of the book, and that is unprepared. It's just that doctors, as they existed back then, were unprepared. There was a medical department of the United States Army, which was incredibly small. I think the number was 80 physicians at the start of the Civil War to take care of all the casualties, and they added numbers of physicians slowly. But at the time of Bull Run, there was just a total lack of preparedness. No one had any expectation that so many people were going to be shot and wounded and dying, and they lay there for days on the battlefield. There were no ambulances. There were no physicians who were told what to do. One of the quotes in the book says, it's like a time when there was no king. No one knew anything. That's what the problem was with the beginnings of Civil War medicine.
There's a quote I'd like you to read by William Williams Keene, who was an assistant surgeon for the 5th Massachusetts Infantry. And he worked out of a makeshift hospital in a church. And I think this describes really beautifully what medicine was like during the Civil War. Would you read this quote for us, but first introduce the context?
Oh, I would love to read this quote. This is a wonderful passage from a book that William Williams Keene wrote. He was a Philadelphia surgeon. And I stress the word surgeon because it's vastly different when you and I think of a surgeon today than what it was back in 1860s. William Keene was asked to become a surgeon to a Massachusetts regiment. And I can only tell you that Williams Keene had been in medical school for 4 months when he was asked to become the surgeon of this entire regiment. So in other words, when you were shot or if you needed your arm amputated, you were going to somebody who had been in medical school. And we're not talking about residency or internship. He'd been in medical school for exactly 4 months. So this is William Keene's story of Civil War medicine, which he wrote approximately 20 years after the end of the Civil War. And this is the quote. We operated in old blood-stained and often pus-stained coats. We operated with clean hands in the social sense, but they were undisinfected hands. We used undisinfected instruments from undisinfected plush-lined cases, and still worse, used marine sponges which had been used in prior pus cases and had only been washed in tap water. If a sponge or an instrument fell on the floor, it was washed and squeezed in a basin of tap water and used as if it were clean. If there was any difficulty in threading the needle, we moistened it with saliva and rolled it between bacteria-infected fingers. We dressed the wounds with clean but undisinfected sheets, shirts, tablecloths, or other old soft linens rescued from the family rag bag. That is the essence, that's the end of the quote, that's the essence of Civil War surgery, certainly at the beginning of the war.
And what were some of the misunderstandings about how diarrhea and typhus were spread, and those were really epidemic on the field in the Civil War?
Well, the misunderstandings were very similar to the surgical problems, and that was a total lack of knowledge of understanding about bacteria and germs, so that they would use dirty water. They would use water that people had bathed in, that people had defecated in, they had urinated in, they had gone to a stream. And upstream people had used it for their daily whatever. They were bathing there, washing clothes, and that stream came down a few yards, and they would use that water to go ahead and cook food with. So they were just passing things on to one another. I mean, we're talking literally about millions of cases of diarrhea, millions of cases of dysentery.
What did the doctors think was causing the diarrhea and the dysentery?
They had no idea. They came up with all thoughts, all sorts of opinions. I remember one of the things I read was it was the cold air was causing it. Another one was that the men were sleeping too close to one another. Third was the fact that they slept in tents where they didn't raise the sides of the tents each day. So they had all these myths about what was causing diseases, but they didn't have fundamental understanding of what disease even was.
What was the state of surgery? So many of the wounded soldiers required amputations. What were amputations like then?
It was something that you and I would not want to participate in. It was not a fun event for the soldiers or for the doctors. Back then, speed was the essence of amputations. And the reason was that anesthesia had just been developed about a decade and a half before. Not everybody had anesthesia available. So it was very often that you would undergo an operation. There might not be anesthesia. And even then, the types and amount of anesthesia they had often was not quite adequate. And the it was a speed event because the doctor or the surgeon had to cut off the extremity, be it the arm or the leg or the finger or the toe, as soon as possible because the patient was screaming, was in agony. And you read excerpts from their diaries and from journals of amputation of an extremity in 90 seconds. I mean, it's unbelievable in today's world that they could do an entire amputation in 90 seconds. But it was different than what you and I perceive today of an amputation.
What were the odds of surviving a surgical amputation?
That's a great question, and everybody always asks that, and I don't have an answer. I can tell you that there were tens of thousands of amputations that were done. We're looking at certain battles where literally hundreds were done in a given day. But I've never seen a statistic of the actual number of people who survived. In other words, how many people became infected? Usually once they became infected, then survival was lessened. And I've never seen a real number on the actual percentages of the people who survived. I would imagine that it was somewhere 50% at best.
You say gangrene was one of the most feared complications for soldiers who were wounded. Why?
Well, there was this entity called hospital gangrene. And hospital gangrene is a disease entity that we do not have today. It doesn't exist. So we don't really know exactly what it was, but it was a massive infection. They talk about it spreading at the rate of an inch an hour on a soldier's body. And you could literally watch the gangrene spread up the soldier's leg or his arm at an inch an hour. And the tissue was just dying. It was probably some type of mixed bacterial infection that would have been easily treated today with antibiotics. But back then, they never heard of the word antibiotics. They had no idea about bacteria. And all they knew what to do was to try and stay ahead of the disease that was advancing. So if the disease was up to the middle of your calf, they would cut up to below your knee. So they would try and stop the disease. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't work. In addition, one of the other treatments was after they did the operation, they would pour nitric acid or other things onto the tissue to try and stop the spread of the disease. Sometimes it was a question of who was going to win the battle. The surgeons were melting away tissue. They were cutting away tissue. The bacteria were doing their thing. It was, in essence, you never really knew who was going to win, but it was a horrible disease process and was easily spread not only from soldier to soldier, but also from soldier to physician, soldier to nurse, soldier to caregivers. It was just a mess.
What were some of the disagreements within the medical profession about how to treat injuries and illness?
I think that was one of the most fascinating things I learned about American medicine at the time. American medicine in the 19th century, certainly up through the 1870s, and maybe even into the 1880s, was a very contentious profession. And I use the word profession very lightly because, I mean, I'm not even sure it was a profession yet in the classic sense. People fought with one another. The surgeons just tended to be very feisty. They were very divisive. They fought with one another constantly about all sorts of things. It was a time of, you know, democracy in America and individualism, and it was a time of independence. So throughout the 19th century, you had this core of doctors who grew up with one another, were constantly arguing with one another. One of the reasons was because it was so unscientific and there was no science involving medicine, they couldn't prove or disprove anything. No one had any idea what was going on. So whatever you said was as legitimate as what the next person said. So the problem was they argued about everything. There was nothing that they didn't argue about. They argued about the way that you did amputations. They argued about when the amputations were done. They argued about whether how you should treat the diarrhea or the dysentery. And the bottom line was no one was right. Everybody was wrong because they didn't understand the very basis of science of medicine.
My guest is Ira Rutko, author of the new book Bleeding Blue and Gray. We'll talk more about Civil War medicine after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is physician and medical historian Ira Rutko, and his new book is called Bleeding Blue and Gray, Civil War Surgery and the Evolution of American Medicine. Let's talk a little bit about the nurses who worked in the Civil War hospitals. They were led by Dorothea Dixon. What were their jobs like?
The nurses' jobs were nothing that you and I, again, could imagine in today's world. One of the reasons was that nursing schools didn't exist, at least at the time they were medical schools. But nursing schools didn't exist. And the concept of a nurse is vastly different in 1860s and Civil War medicine than anything that we can think of today. If you were a wife and your husband had been shot and you went down to the hospital to find him and to hopefully take care of him, you then became a nurse. You were given the title of nurse. So that women who were washing women, who followed the troops around and washed the clothing, they were entitled nurse. In addition, there was a formal group led by Dorothea Dix, as you said, a United States Nursing Corps established by the government, and she recruited nurses, but there were really not many of them, maybe 100 or 200 who served during the course of the war. The vast majority of nurses were people who volunteered on their own, went down to the various hospitals, went to work in the hospitals. It was this amorphous group. It wasn't a real fixed group. And they think that approximately 3,000 to 5,000 women served as nurses throughout the Civil War. But again, their duties were vastly different than what you and I know today.
Two of the people who served as nurses on a volunteer basis, as you're describing, were Louisa May Alcott, who wrote Little Women, and the great poet Walt Whitman. How much did they write about their Civil War experiences?
Well, Louisa May Alcott wrote an awful lot that came out of the Civil War. Many of her books portrayed her time as a nurse at the Union Square Hospital. It was not really a long time that she was in service. She was only there for approximately 2 or 3 weeks and then left. Her father brought her back. Walt Whitman went to search for his brother, who he thought had been shot. It ended up that the brother was fine and had not really been wounded much. And Walt Whitman ended up staying in Washington area for maybe 1 to 2 years, taking care of the wounded, writing back to his newspaper, the Brooklyn Eagle, daily reports of what was happening with the war. So Whitman was there much longer than Louisa May Alcott.
Well, she got sick, and that's one of the reasons why she left. She got very sick.
She got horribly sick. She was at this hospital. She got very, very sick. The woman who had, who was her, what they called her matron, Hannah Ropes, who I also write about, she had instructed Louisa May Alcott on what to do, what not to do. Louisa May Alcott lasted approximately 2 weeks before she came down with what was either dysentery or typhoid. No one really knows what everybody was having back then, but she became deathly ill and almost died. And Hannah Ropes, the woman who was recruiting her and who was her matron, died the day that Louisa May Alcott's father took Louisa May Alcott back to Massachusetts.
Although there weren't really any breakthroughs during the Civil War in the way of antibiotics or anesthesia or an understanding of germs, there were breakthroughs in terms of sanitary conditions. And you credit a lot of that to the Sanitary Commission, which was run by Frederick Law Olmsted.
Yes.
And before we go any further with him, maybe you could read a quote in which he described the conditions that he faced in the war.
Well, this is a quote, and Frederick Law Olmsted was writing to Henry Bellows, who had sort of founded the United States Sanitary Commission. The Sanitary Commission was a philanthropic group. It was not involved with the military. It was not involved with the federal government. It was a volunteer group that was going to help the soldiers, the wounded soldiers, to provide sort of home-like conditions at the time of the battles. They were going to provide food and basics that they needed. And if they were shot, they were going to provide medical things. And Olmsted was on the what they called the peninsula at the time, which was in Virginia. And it was in the middle of a very bad campaign. Many of the Union soldiers had been shot. And this was in the days following the Battle of Fair Oaks. And I quote, "At the time of which I am now writing, Monday afternoon, wounded were arriving by every train, entirely unattended, or with at most a detail of two soldiers to a train of 200 or 300 of them. They were packed as closely as they could be stowed in the common freight cars, without beds, without straw, at most with a wisp of hay under their heads. They arrived, dead and alive together, in the same closed box, many with awful wounds, festering and alive with maggots. The stench was such as to produce vomiting with some of our strong men, habituated to the duty of attending the sick and wounded of the army." End of quote. And that was what army life was for the wounded following a major battle. They were all packed in cars. They were shipped together. They gave one another an infection. If one had been shot and his wound got infected, then the next one got it. They all touched one another. Same dressing, same sponges as we had discussed previously.
And that was a description written by Frederick Law Olmsted, who headed the Sanitary Commission. What did Olmsted go on to become famous for?
Well, Olmsted actually was famous almost already at the time of the Civil War. He was a young man. He was in his 30s when they asked him. And I have to preface everything by saying that all the men in this book, other than for the nurses who were the women, all the men were very young. Even Louisa May Alcott, they were in their 20s when they went to war. The Surgeon General of the United States Army was 32. Olmsted was in his 30s. He was famous already at that time because they had planned and were in the process of developing Central Park in New York City. And he was the major designer and organizer and ran the construction crews that were designing that. And he went on after the war to become very famous as a landscape architect.
So what did the Sanitary Commission under Olmsted's direction do to improve the conditions at the Civil War hospitals?
Well, I think very specific things were done by the Sanitary Commission. They were able to, for whatever reason, bring in supplies, both medical and non-medical supplies, to the battles before the federal government was able to get things in. And in fact, Olmsted often writes to his wife, Mary, that he says he's most proud of the fact that he was able to get shiploads and car and freight loads of railroad cars into battlefield sites before the federal government was able to get their own supplies in. And the reason was because the members of the Sanitary Commission, men like Olmsted and Bellows and other people who were running it, stayed on top of the situation. They sent their literally spies and other people out to find out where they thought the next battle was going to be. And they made sure that if the battle was going to, let's say, be near Richmond in the next month or so, they began stockpiling things sort of near that area so they could rush them into the battlefield right after the battle. So the Sanitary Commission proved very, very important in terms of organizing and helping the troops both before, during, and after the battle.
You described that there were breakthroughs in hospital design during the Civil War as people started to pick up on the suggestions that Florence Nightingale had made earlier. What were some of those suggestions that were adopted in the States?
Well, I found out in my readings and my research that prior to the Civil War, hospitals, as you and I know, really didn't exist. They were very small places, log cabins often. They were almshouses. The poor went to the hospitals to die. There was no great hospitals where there were all these scientific discoveries where you went to get the latest and greatest in medical knowledge. That just didn't exist. But eventually, throughout the course of the Civil War, they began to realize they needed to have hospitals. And this concept came about directly related to Florence Nightingale and her experience in the Crimean War of what they call pavilion hospitals. And pavilion hospitals are the forerunner to what you and I know as the large modern hospital of today. Pavilion hospitals were these immense structures that could hold 2,000 and 3,000 men at a time, where they would have a central corridor, an office corridor, would be radiating these huge pavilions that could hold 80 or 100 men. And they might have 20 or 30 of these pavilions sort of based around this core. And this concept of cleanliness, and that things had to have air flow through it, and that you needed to have less dirt, so they reduced the number of right angles in these buildings. These were all concepts that came out of the Civil War. And eventually, they led to the building of the great hospitals in America that started in the 1880s and the 1890s, that now we perceive as the modern American hospital.
Now, you said that there weren't really medical breakthroughs during the Civil War. There were breakthroughs in sanitary conditions, but no real new medical discoveries. But not long after the Civil War, there were breakthroughs in antibiotics and understanding of microorganisms. Was the Civil War connected in any way to those breakthroughs, even though it didn't happen at that time?
No, and I write that it was very sad for what happened during the Civil War, because the Civil War, 1861 to 1865, came about at the time where we were on this cusp of the scientific revolution in medicine. But that scientific revolution did not really come about until the 1870s into the 1880s. So that Civil War medicine, again, in the 1860s, was almost the same as what had been practiced in the 1500s, in the 900s, in the 200s, and in the BCs. And that's the sad part about the Civil War. If it had happened 10 to 15 years later, you would have seen dramatic changes in the way that people were being taken care of.
Ira Rutko, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very, very welcome.
Ira Rutko is the author of the new book, Bleeding Blue and Gray, Civil War Surgery and the Evolution of American Medicine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new film Mysterious Skin is about two boys who are sexually molested and affected in completely different ways. Coming up, we talk with the film's director and producer, Greg Araki, and Scott Heim, the author of the novel the film's based on. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novel by Martha Cooley. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, Mysterious Skin, tells the parallel stories of 2 8-year-old boys who are sexually molested by their Little League coach and affected in completely different ways. One later becomes a gay prostitute. The other is so traumatized, he blanks out the memories and is haunted by his inability to account for the missing time. All he knows is that something terrible happened. He later comes to believe that the only explanation is that he was abducted by aliens. The movie traces the lives of these two boys into their late teens. My guests are Greg Araki, the director, screenwriter, and producer of the film, and Scott Heim, author of the novel Mysterious Skin, which the movie's based on. The New York Times film critic A.O. Scott wrote, "The film's subject matter may be grim. Mr. Araki addresses the characters' sexual experiences with unflinching candor. But Mysterious Skin is infused with remarkable tenderness and beauty. It's one of the best movies I've seen so far this year." The Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Michael Cunningham said about novelist Scott Heim, "He's a serious writer who's unafraid to swim in the darkest waters." Scott Heim, Greg Araki, welcome to Fresh Air. Scott Heim, let me start with you. You wrote the novel that the new film Mysterious Skin is based on. Why did you want to compare how two boys were affected by being sexually abused by their Little League coach?
Well, I think the initial sort of genesis of the book came about because I had written a short story that was about a kid who had been sexually abused in his past. And then I started writing a short story, you know, just completely separately about a boy who thinks he has, you know, memories of a UFO abduction. And, you know, they were quite a different time period away from each other. But I realized at some point just how similar people's memories are, or, you know, when people go under hypnosis for supposed alien abduction, the things they say are just really similar to the things people say when they, you know, have sort of recovered memory of child abuse or molestation.
What are some of those similarities between abduction stories and recovered memories?
Well, I think, you know, initially what I was struck by was just sort of some of the, you know, sort of the tactile things that people were reporting, and, you know, things like the way it felt to be examined on a table or touched by these sort of extraterrestrial hands, and, you know, how people feel violated when, you know, they think they've, you know, been examined by aliens. And, you know, sometimes when people read the book, or sometimes when I've explained the book to people, people kind of nervously laugh, or, you know, it's usually the skeptical people that think, you know, that's just silly. Why would people actually believe that happened to them? But, you know, I hope that in writing the book, and I think Greg would maybe say the same thing in making the movie, I didn't want to discount those people's stories, because, you know, I don't know if those stories are real or imagined or fake. I just know that a lot of people have those, you know, memories or have those experiences that they, you know, they think they honestly had. And it's just fascinating to me how similar they are to the people who, you know, bury their memories of being molested. And, you know, when they come out in hypnosis, the things they say are very, very similar.
Greg Araki, why did you want to make a film based on Scott Heim's novel Mysterious Skin? What did you relate to about the story?
I first read the book back in 1995 when it was first published. And it really just floored me. I mean, I've never read such a powerful story. It had a huge kind of emotional impact on me. And I was really struck by how Scott managed to tell this very dark, very unsettling story, but in this incredibly beautiful and poetic language. And we really tried to translate that to the screen in our adaptation. I mean, Scott, I think, is an extraordinarily talented writer, and the way he uses language was it was so lyrical and so beautiful, and we really wanted to sort of replicate that with the cinematography and the design of the movie.
Well, I'd like to compare how you each handled a pivotal scene from early in the story, and this is a scene in which the coach, the Little League coach, seduces Neil. And it shows the shift in tone that the coach uses. You know, first, you know, the coach alternates between being very seductive and clowning around as if he were another child. Neil has gone back to the coach's house. The coach's house is filled with video games and toys and the kinds of foods that kids love. In fact, the food that figures into this particular scene is a variety pack of cereals, you know, the kind of pack that has lots of small boxes of different cereals in it. And I want to play a clip from the film. And it starts with the coach in his apartment sitting next to Neil. And the coach is putting his hand on Neil's leg.
Neil, I've been thinking a lot about you this week.
I'm hungry.
Sure. You want a pizza? I might have something here you'd like.
Whoa.
What'll it be, little buddy?
My mom never buys these things. She says they're a big waste of money.
Let's eat then.
A scene from Mysterious Skin. And at this point in the scene, the coach chooses his favorite sugared cereal, and Neil, the boy, chooses his favorite sugared cereal. And as they start to eat, Neil accidentally spills some cereal, and he feels bad, and the coach says, don't worry about it. And the coach starts just taking his cereal and throwing it up in the air. And then they both start opening up cereal boxes and tossing the cereal up in the air. And after this moment of childish abandon, the coach starts molesting the boy. Scott Heim, the movie Mysterious Skin is based on your novel of the same name. Can you talk a little bit about writing this scene and why you set this first molestation in this environment of childhood exuberance and child of kid cereal, you know, of the kind of sugared cereals that children eat, and the cereal is now all over the floor?
Well, obviously, the whole book for me, writing the whole book in a lot of ways, is about juxtaposing extremes. For instance, I wanted to have this really dark material set in Kansas, where I'm from, because people usually think of Kansas as this sort of serene, safe place. And so for me, that scene, literally the first molestation or first, you know, sexual encounter between the boy and the man in the movie, you know, takes place on top of the spilled cereal and on the kitchen floor. So I wanted to have kind of this really bright, colorful image of childhood, which, you know, sort of the brightest kind of child cereal that you can think of, and sort of use that as the bed for where this initial, you know, sort of horrifying, life-changing sexual experience takes place. And, you know, for me, that was kind of the scene that, it was one of the first scenes in the book that I wrote, and I was actually writing the book when I was getting my MFA degree at Columbia, and that was kind of the scene that a lot of my classmates bristled at, and a lot of people said, you know, I think you're going too far with this, and people are really going to be angry. And my teacher pulled me aside and said, listen, this is kind of going to be the thing that drives your book, and you know, sure, it will make people angry, but it's kind of one of the major, you know, turning points of your book. So she, you know, suggested that I sort of go further with it, and I did.
Greg Araki, can you talk about directing the scene in the film, what you wanted to show or imply? And I want to say that the coach in this scene is really behaving like a kid. And he's even, like, when he's throwing the cereal up in the air, he's sticking his tongue out in the kind of way that some children do when they're concentrating on trying to read or draw. And he's so behaving like a child, but then he turns around and becomes this, you know, sexual molester.
Bill Sage, the actor who plays the coach, I think did an amazing job with his character. I mean, obviously, it's extremely challenging role for an actor. And he really sort of keyed into that idea that the coach was sort of, in a way, this sort of overgrown boy and had turned his house sort of into this boys' club. I mean, the scene, you know, as we're talking about it, I mean, is probably one of the most disturbing scenes in the whole book. But it was really so important to me as a filmmaker to not take this scene out of the film adaptation, because it was one of the scenes that really sort of blew me away when I read it. I mean, it is disturbing, but there's such a sort of rawness and such a sort of truth to it, and it's really I think one of the most powerful scenes in the book and in the film. The tricky part was that I didn't want to traumatize the young boy who's playing young Neil, 8-year-old Chase Allison. And it was very important to the producer, Mary Jane, and I to not traumatize any children in the making of this film about childhood trauma. So what we ended up doing was the film is that scene is extremely cleverly shot in a way, in the sense that It's really all in the sort of editing and in that use of subjective camera and eye line, like where the actors are actually looking. And we had to film the scene. I wanted to like keep the scene for all its sort of, you know, the importance it had to the story, but I wanted to also film it in a way where the young boy could be protected from what the scene was actually about. And this was basically true of the whole film. Both Chase and George were George Webster plays young Brian. They were kept from what the actual. They had never read the entire script and sort of only did their scenes beat by beat and kind of moment by moment. And we had to sort of construct this almost alternate reality, or an alternate movie that the kids were actually performing in.
But you know, in this scene, what happens between the coach and the boy is implied. We don't see it.
Yeah, and it's actually filmed in. For people who are very astute sort of film students or filmmakers, they can see how the scene is shot in two halves. So the halves are brought together through editing, so it feels like this extremely horrifying thing is actually happening when it really is kind of. It never happened in reality, but it's happening on the screen.
Now Neil, the boy in this scene, he basically knows as a child that he's attracted to other men. And before the coach molests him, first time he sees the coach, he's thinking, wow, this guy reminds me of the kind of guys that, you know, that he loves to look at in magazines, that kind of Marlboro man type with the mustache, the macho kind of looking guy. In the actual novel, the character thinks, remembering back to this moment, desire sledgehammered my body. Does that make the coach's actions any less reprehensible to either of you? The fact that the boy is actually attracted to the coach.
Yeah, that was one of the things about the book that, you know, as I said before, was really what makes the book for me such a powerful kind of experience, or what makes the story such a powerful experience, is the way that Scott has sort of constructed it in the way that there are these two boys. There's, you know, Brian, who is, you know, fair-haired and blonde and, you know, is very introverted and believes that he was abducted by an alien. He sort of blocks this trauma out of his memory. And then there's Neil, who's dark-haired and who's from a very young age gay and has this, you know, gay desire for the coach. The fact that there are both of these stories, and these boys in a way sort of function as yin and yang and dark and light to each other, both their stories combined, and the way in which they each experience this trauma and then deal with it in polar opposite ways, the sort of aftermath of what happens to them, I think that's, for me, what really makes the story work.
My guests are Greg Araki, the producer, director, and writer of the new film Mysterious Skin, and Scott Heim, author of the novel Mysterious Skin, which the movie's based on. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Greg Araki, the producer, director, and writer of the new film Mysterious Skin, and Scott Heim, author of the novel Mysterious Skin, which the movie's based on. The movie tells the parallel stories of two boys who are sexually molested by their Little League coach. Brian is so traumatized he blanks out all memory of what's happened. Neil, who had a crush on the coach, becomes a male prostitute. You know, the character of Neil, as a teenager looking back on this experience of being sexually molested by the coach, thinks half of me realized it wasn't right, the other half wanted it to happen. And he also thinks, oftentimes I wonder where Coach lives now, what he's doing, whether something like prison or lynch mobs or disease hasn't killed him. But looking back, it doesn't matter. What matters is how, for the first time in my life, I felt as if I existed for something. So, you know, although this child turns into a male prostitute, although his sexual life has been kind of deformed by this experience of abuse, he has some fond memories of Coach. Coach cared about him, he thinks. And you know, I think a lot of people will be very uncomfortable hearing this degree of ambiguity in Neil's experience of being abused.
I mean, for people who've been abused, I mean, I've heard statistics as high as 1 in 4 children in America are experience some sort of sexual abuse, and that I think is what is so powerful about the story, is that it is ambivalent for a lot of people, and it does, and then there's the guilt associated with that. I mean, Joe Gordon-Levitt, who does such an amazing job playing 18-year-old Neil, is kind of a method actor, and he and I had a lot of talks about Neil's character, and because Neil does talk about the coach in this very sort of idealized way, almost kind of romantic way, talking about how he is the one true love of his life, and how, you know, when the summer that they were together was sort of, you know, this affair that he kind of can't forget. And you know, my feelings had always been, I mean, Scott might feel differently having you know, being much closer to the characters than me, but as somebody, as when I read the book, and you know, my sort of take on the film as I was directing it was really feeling like, in a way, Neil is more damaged even than Brian. I mean, Brian, the boy who believes he was abducted, you know, is you know, introverted, nervous, asexual, wets the bed, has these blackouts and nosebleeds. I mean, he's just sort of a nervous wreck, essentially, after this trauma. Whereas Neil, on the surface, is, you know, this sort of beautiful James Dean, rebel without a cause, kind of sexual, you know, the sexy sort of bad boy. But he's acting out in this incredibly sort of self-destructive way, this kind of hypersexual self-destructive way. And I think that his damage is so much, it's so much deeper and so much more sort of internalized. I mean, Joe and I talked a lot about how Neil is sort of incapable of attachment and connection, and that, you know, one of the characters says about Neil that, you know, he has a black hole where his heart should be. And as always, my feeling that, you know, the Neil character, I feel like at the end of the movie, he sort of realizes that he, and Brian has been living in this sort of fantasy world of believing he was abducted, and I think Neil in his own way has a kind of awakening in terms of he's sort of seeing his abuse and for the first time without the sort of rose-colored glasses of his first, you know, crush.
As I mentioned, in the novel, the first time that the boy Neil sees Coach, you know, he's already attracted to men. And looking back, he remembers that the first time he saw Coach, he thought, desire sledgehammered my body. And in the movie, what you do, Greg, the first time Neil sees Coach, and Coach is running towards him because this is at the Little League field.
Running towards him in slow motion.
In slow motion, as if it's one of those corny romance movies where...
It's like Bo Derek in 10.
Exactly, exactly. And I thought, that's such a kind of clever way of getting at that, like, inappropriately romantic feeling that the boy has. Can you talk about deciding to do it that way?
I wanted that moment that, I mean, obviously the coach is going to change Neil's life in a profound way, and you know, so there was that sort of corny, cliched slow motion moment, but it's true, interesting, when people have a moment like that where they meet somebody that's going to change their life, frequently they describe it in, you know, cheesy movie terms as like a slow motion moment. And so that was very kind of natural. The reverse shot of Chase was actually that shot was the idea of the cinematographer Steve Gaynor, who, the amazing Steve Gaynor.
It's one of those track zooms where there's a close-up of young Neil staring at the coach, and his background is sort of shifting, but the size of his face in the frame is staying the same because of the shifting perspective of the lens. So it's sort of this kind of compressing moment for young Neil. And then it's also sort of intercut with these flash frames of these kind of cheesy playgirl type centerfolds from the 70s. So, which is kind of a reference to a scene that's more developed in the book, where young Neil discovers these Playgirl magazines as a young boy under his mother's bed. And that was actually one of the scenes in the book that really, really, like, kind of nailed me, in the sense that specific. It's such a vivid memory for me that I can. I think I was slightly older, maybe like 10 or 11, but I remember the first time I saw my first like Playgirl centerfold, and it was that kind of a moment. Like it really sort of. Well, it's like a revelation for me.
I want to thank you both for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank
this
you.
Has been great.
Greg Araki wrote, directed, and produced the new movie Mysterious Skin. It's based on the novel of the same name by Scott Heim. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel 33 Swoons by Martha Cooley. This is Fresh Air. Martha Cooley's 1998 debut novel, The Archivist, was an improbable bestseller. It imaginatively delved into the emotional life of the poet T.S. Eliot. Cooley has just published her second novel, 33 Swoons, which our book critic Maureen Corrigan says is also an unexpected mixture of fact and fiction, memory and desire.
Many years ago, I had the perfect low-to-high culture night out in New York City. One that began with dinner in a greasy spoon coffee shop and ended with listening to Bobby Short at the Carlyle Hotel. The highlight of that evening, though, was seeing the British actress Fiona Shaw in a one-woman performance of T.S. Eliot's poem, The Wasteland. It was staged in a derelict theater in Times Square. Bare light bulbs hung from the ceiling, and beautifully dressed theatergoers who felt the call of nature had to resort to porta-potties out on the sidewalk. In this ideal post-apocalyptic setting, Shaw made me experience The Wasteland for the first time as a deeply emotional work of art. After years of studying the poem and teaching it as an intellectual jigsaw puzzle, I felt it for the first time, felt the desperation in all those voices trying to hold their splintering world together. In her best-selling debut novel, The Archivist, Martha Cooley worked much the same revelatory magic on T.S. Eliot himself. Without diminishing his identity as an intellectual, Cooley brought to the fore an Eliot who was a man of feeling. Cooley's intricately plotted novel itself appealed both to readers' brains and hearts. Now Cooley has just published her second novel, called 33 Swoons, and though it doesn't quite evade the dreaded curse of the second book, it's still a really intriguing novel. I probably sound like I'm damning 33 Swoons with faint praise, but I don't mean to. Even a mildly flawed novel, like this one by Cooley, is worth reading, because unlike so many of her literary contemporaries, Cooley has mastered the art of folding historical figures into her fiction without making the final product feel gimmicky or cannibalistic. Cooley's sweep in 33 Swoons is every bit as ambitious as it was in her debut. The plot roams from the Russian Revolution to contemporary life in New York with layovers in the Paris of the 20s thrown in. A rough summary of the story goes like this. A 50-ish divorced woman named Camilla Archer, who owns a theater memorabilia shop in New York, is reeling from the sudden death of her older cousin, Eve. After Eve's death, Camilla begins having strange dreams about her father, Jordan, another family member who, like Eve, was intensely erotic yet emotionally distant. Also starring in these dreams is the real-life figure of Siavolod Meyerhold, a famous Russian theater director who was murdered during Stalin's reign of terror. The disturbing dreams are in fact conjured up by Meyerhold's doppelganger, a kind of provocative shadow spirit who's decided to burrow into Camilla's dream world because of her theatrical background and because Jordan, who traveled the globe inventing rare perfumes, once met Meyerhold. Besides, this devilish sprite explains, Camilla needs some serious scaring out of her soft cocoon of a life. That's just the bare bones of Cooley's plot, and her language throughout is every bit as haunting as her premise. Here, for instance, is how Camilla describes her father's profound understanding of the power of scent. My father's perfumes melded coolness and warmth, elegance and carnality. For Jordan, perfume was more than anything else an acknowledgement of impermanence. Fragrance is time-bound. It ends in decay. Rather than attempting to deny or overcome this reality, Jordan found ways of exploiting it. He orchestrated his fragrance's lifespans like beautifully shaped musical compositions. Magically mobile, they registered in the mind like a dream. Perfume, whether it be the expensive stuff or the drugstore variety, gives me a headache. I haven't worn it in years. But Cooley's sensual meditations made me want to pop a preemptive migraine pill and douse myself in Chanel. Indeed, her descriptive powers are spellbinding. But occasionally that spell is broken by irritants having to do with plot or character development. For instance, it feels like foul play when Cooley withholds information from readers, information that's common knowledge to her characters and crucial to the epiphany of the novel. Also, Camilla, the Prufrockian main character who needs a supernatural shove into the active life, doesn't seem sufficiently different from a lot of the other characters here, who also sit around and brood a lot. 33 Swoons is perhaps itself not swoon-inducing. Rather, like a very fine but not superb perfume concocted by Jordan, it fascinates, troubles, and faintly lingers.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed 33 Swoons by Martha Cooley. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the past, present, and future of Medicare. We talk with Jonathan Oberlander, the author of a book on Medicare. He's a political scientist at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and has written extensively on the politics of health care. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. I guess a Gregor